Welcome to AUSA's Army Matters. I am Mzinga Curry.
And I am Major Brad Cooper.
And together, we bring you Army Real Talk. Today, we are focusing on debunking Barrett's lawyer's myths. And I am so excited about having Lieutenant Colonel Megan Wakefair, who is the Chief of Strategic Communication for the Office of the Judge Advocate General, and Lieutenant Colonel Adam Kazin, who is the Chief of Policy for Criminal Law Division of the Office of the Judge Advocate General. Welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Yeah. Hey, thanks for coming out today, guys. So, ma'am, this is a request that we have received from most of our listeners today. So there's a lot of folks out there, a lot of soldiers, leaders, commanders, sergeants, majors, you know, that are asking us to, hey, help us debunk some of these barracks lawyers myths. And I know from my experience, I always had that one specialist or that one, you know, lieutenant that was in my company, be like, oh, that's not true, sir. You know, and then I would have to go and pull out my handy dandy UCMJ guide that was issued to me by my judge advocate and prove them wrong or call that person up for advice.
Oh.
So hopefully today, the two lieutenant colonels can help us debunk a lot of the myths that are out there.
Excellent. I know that we continue, AUSA continue to receive questions from our AUSA chapters, as well as our Army civilians. So I'm looking forward to this podcast. So we're first going to have our guest provide an introduction. We'll start with you, Lieutenant Colonel Wakefair.
So my name is Lieutenant Colonel Megan Wakefield. I work in the Office of the Judge Advocate General doing strategic communications. Most of my career in the JAG Corps has been focused on military justice. I've spent about 9 of my 16 plus years in the Army focused on UCMJ and advising both commanders and also clients as a trial defense services attorney. I've also taught at the Judge Advocate General's Legal Center and School in the Criminal Law Department. And I've advised commanders both as a brigade judge advocate and as a trial counsel.
And as mentioned before, my name is Adam Kazin. I'm currently the chief of policy for what's called OTJAG Criminal Law Division. We basically review legislation, regulations, anything dealing with military justice and see what policies, how they're going to be implemented or what we can do to make better policy through either legislation or regulation. I've spent about 11 of my 17 years doing military justice. Either as a prosecutor, an appellate attorney, a regional defense counsel, so I've been on both sides of the aisle. And then 2 years as a brigade judge advocate and a year as a deputy staff judge advocate advising commanders. So a good chunk of my career mostly has been advising commanders on military justice matters.
So as you can see, listeners, we have a wealth of knowledge here today to answer all the questions that you guys have sent in. So but first, before we start this off, Lieutenant Colonels have to put out a disclaimer.
So anything that either Colonel Kazin or I might say that's our own opinion does not necessarily reflect the views of the Department of Defense or of the Army.
It would also say that this is, don't take this as legal advice directly to you that will solve your particular problem or issue. Just like you probably shouldn't take legal advice from a barracks lawyer, you shouldn't accept legal advice from a recorded podcast. Legal advice is
good
very
point.
Legal advice is very personal and individual. And so if you're getting legal advice, you'd probably either be face-to-face with a lawyer. If it's a criminal law matter, you probably need to go see trial defense service if you're being accused of a crime. And if it's another matter, most likely legal assistance.
Great. So we're excited. Let's jump right in with the questions.
So one of our first questions, and this is probably the question that we got the most. So discuss the difference between UCMJ and administrative punishment.
Okay. So when a soldier commits misconduct, the commander has a range of options to address that misconduct. Anything from what we would call administrative procedures all the way through a court-martial. So administratively, the commander has options like memorandums of reprimand. General officer memorandum of reprimand, for example, is an administrative tool. And with that, you also would see something like a separation or what soldiers commonly refer to as being chaptered out of the Army. So it's basically being fired from the Army. In both of those instances, whether it's a reprimand or a separation, a soldier is given notice of the fact that the commander wants to take that action against the soldier and an opportunity to respond, either in writing or in person, depending on the level of, say, separation, the type of discharge that the commander is seeking to give the soldier. So that's the due process requirement that we have for those administrative procedures. Then you have non-judicial punishment under Article 15, which I'm sure most of the listeners have heard of and are somewhat familiar with. Article 15s are basically a hearing where a commander, either a company grade commander or a field grade commander, depending on the Article 15, will take evidence and will adjudicate the misconduct. So either saying that the soldier is guilty or not guilty of that misconduct. And then the soldier can present matters in mitigation and extenuation. The commander will then impose punishment on that soldier subject to Article 15. Soldiers are able to get trial defense services advice before accepting Article 15 or non-judicial punishment from their commander, and they have the option of turning that down and demanding trial by court-martial. There are several different layers of courts-martial. There's summary court-martial, special court-martial, and general court-martial. A summary court-martial is not a court-martial in the strict sense in that the result is not a federal conviction. A summary court-martial is a hearing before a summary court-martial officer to, again, determine, just like in Article 15, whether or not the soldier is guilty or not guilty of the misconduct charge, and then to impose a punishment. At a summary court-martial, a soldier who is an E4 or below could potentially receive 30 days in jail, 30 wow. days in confinement.
Yeah, I remember that.
But that is not a federal conviction, and it is appealable. The other types of courts martial that we have, if a soldier is found guilty at those courts martial, that is a federal conviction.
Okay.
And you can receive anything from no punishment all the way to life in prison without the possibility of parole. And we also do have capital punishment in the military. So there's a whole range. And the maximum punishments are all found in the manual for courts martial. So if you're curious about what the maximum punishment of a certain offense is, you can always head over and look that up in the MCM.
So let me ask you all this. So when I was in company command, you know, I had soldiers that would either, you know, smart off or not do something or show up late. And it's sort of like a first offense, or we're out in the field and we're having these issues, whatever the case may be. But my NCOs basically said they had no to limited corrective training, basically. So can you guys kind of define, like, what is the corrective training that the NCO or that leader should be doing, and then, like, what they shouldn't be doing type stuff?
Well, the nice thing about the Army is that you can find it all in writing, right?
It's true, so, sir. Yes, sir.
Really, the policy for corrective training is found in 600-20. And I probably don't have a specific site, but go to 600-20. Search and corrective training, there's a whole section on it. And really the policy is that the corrective training should have some nexus to the deficiency, because it's you're supposed to be training the soldier. And so what we typically see is the concern is that what the NCO or the leader is often runs astray is when they lose their temper or they're just angry
yep.
and they just want to make the soldier feel some pain. And we have a word for that. That's called punishment.
That's true.
And so we have to ask yourself. And so I would sit down with, you know, as a brigade judge advocate, I would sit down with my first sergeants and my company commanders, and we talk it over. And I say, what is it that you're trying to accomplish? You know, and look at the reg, and look at the guidance that is given to us in both 600-20 and FM7-22. And the whole idea is that you're supposed to be quickly rehabilitating the soldier. Corrective training should be related to the deficiency. It should be quick, and it should be over with, and the soldier should go back to duties. And so the example I often received was my soldier was 5 minutes late to formation. And the NCO believed that they had to then, okay, I have to do a counseling statement, and I have to go and make the soldier show up early, 15 minutes every formation, which means that I have to be early to every formation, like 30 minutes early. And that just, I just want to drop the soldier for some pushups.
Yep.
And what I said is, well, if you look at what it means to be directly related, when a soldier is late for formation, they've shown a lack of discipline, a momentary lack of discipline, and they've failed to acknowledge your authority to make them be on time. So by quickly dropping them for 10, 15, 20 pushups, you have reinforced your disciplinary authority over them, and they are immediately returned to duty. And so it's related to the deficiency. It is quick. It does not cause the soldier pain or disruption to the unit, and everyone goes back to work. The creativity of NCOs sometimes can be problematic. And so what we saw,
I have 10, some creative NCOs, I'll tell you that.
10, 15, 20 years ago is some of the more creative, what they would call corrective training, but was really just punishing. I mean, we had soldiers building walls in Afghanistan. We had doing 300, 400 push-ups. We had obstacle course, just some stuff that was really designed to punish the soldier. And so the Army became a little more restrictive in their policies and a little more restrictive because there was a lot of concern and there was a lot of cases. And once something goes from being an anecdote to being a trend, the Army leadership responds and saying, hey, we maybe don't trust you as much as we used to. But what I will say is that, you know, if you have a concern in your unit with being able to discipline the soldiers under corrective training or to train your soldiers to be disciplined, work with your leadership. And if there is a legal concern, work with your brigade legal office, because every brigade has one, to make sure you have the parameters down. But simply just, and if you don't like the policies, that's the great thing about like FM7-22, it's a TRADOC policy.
Yep.
Go to TRADOC, ask them to change the doctrine. And really what S7-22 is doctrine. We don't put policies in FMs, we put doctrine in FMs. So you can work to get better clarification through your leadership. But what you have to understand is that is your goal to train the soldier or punish the soldier? And you should, you know, start with the training. And if the soldier just can't get on time, well, then you're going to start counseling, and then you're going to start looking at Article 15s, sort of a rules for the use of force. You're going to increase your levels of force or levels of responsiveness to that situation. But you simply don't just throw up your hands and say, well, what you heard is that you can't do anything, because that's just not true. There's lots that you can do to train your soldiers and to keep your soldiers disciplined. You just got to make sure that you're not acting out of emotion and the desire to punish as opposed to the desire to train.
Gotcha.
And I think corrective training is effective. We need to take that to the civilian world. So when my subordinates are late, I can,
say, drop them for some push-ups.
There you go.
No. I would throw that to your HR department.
Yes.
HR has a say-so on that one, man.
Absolutely.
I will say something that Adam just brought up that I think is really important is the statement that one of the great things about the Army is that there are answers everywhere, and they're usually found in regulation. So I really think it's important, if you haven't read 600-20, take a look at it. There's a lot of really great things in there for you. So if you have questions, that's really where I would start as a commander or as a first sergeant or as a leader in a unit, is take a look at that regulation. You'll be surprised at how quickly you can answer these questions.
Okay. Yeah.
All right. So sometimes it seems as if the civilian world or the civilian system is less harsh when you look at the military punishment for crimes and infractions versus the civilian courts that are imposed. So please explain the double jeopardy with civilian cases and UCMJ.
Okay, so there's two questions in there. One is civilian punishment more harsh than military punishment? There hasn't been a true, I think, comparative analysis because our crimes are, we have a bunch of different crimes. There is no AWOL for the civilian world. So there's a series of crimes that that exist in the military system that don't exist in the civilian world, what we call purely military offenses. But what I would say is that there's really no data to support that punishments are worse or better in the civilian versus the military justice system. It really depends on what offenses you're talking about. Like I said, because we have a series of offenses in the military justice system that don't even apply, they might seem worse. Mm-hmm. But there are some offenses that there are mandatory minimums in the civilian world. Child pornography being a great example of where there's a mandatory minimum in the civilian world. Sometimes it's 5-10 years. That mandatory minimum does not carry over to the military justice system. So you can get anywhere from 0 days of confinement to 20 years of confinement.
What?
So it's a broader category. So I would say that you just can't make a blanket assertion. You know, DUIs is another example where it could vary from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. The second part of your question was the double jeopardy question. And it's timely because the Supreme Court just 3 or 4 days ago issued an opinion in a case called Gamble versus United States that touched on this issue. And it's called the dual sovereignty exception to the double jeopardy clause. And what it says is, so if, let's say, Major Cooper here goes outside, has 5 or 6 beers, gets drunk, and starts driving around Arlington and gets pulled over. Okay, when he has done that, he has violated 2 sets of laws for 2 different sovereigns. He has violated the DUI laws of the Great Commonwealth of Virginia. He has also violated the Uniform Code of Military Justice provision, I think Article 111. One is federal law, one is state law. And what the Supreme Court said is those are 2 sovereigns and 2 separate offenses. So double jeopardy under the Fifth Amendment does not prohibit each sovereign from exercising control over their particular offense. So, yes, you can actually be court-martialed for a DUI and be prosecuted in state court for DUI, and that is perfectly legal.
Wow.
Okay.
Don't drink and drive, kids.
Now, where there is, if that same offense would have occurred on a military installation where his DUI would have been prosecuted by civilian federal authorities, that is because we have what I call privity between federal systems. So a crime under the UCMJ cannot also be prosecuted by a federal district court. So there's a lot of different interplays. And then there's foreign courts if you happen to be overseas. So it is, however, Army policy, and this is in Army Regulation 2710, that double prosecutions are disfavored. So, in order, so if someone is getting prosecuted by the state of Virginia for DUI, it is unlikely that they will also be prosecuted or given an Article 15 for that same DUI because it's simply disfavored. Okay. It's more of a fairness argument than anything else. Okay. What's required at that point is actually the general court martial convening authority would have to approve some sort of a judicial or non-judicial punishment against the soldier. Again, pretty rare, but it's happened on occasion. In fact, we've prosecuted people for murder who have been acquitted in the state system for that very murder.
Right. Okay.
So it does happen. What it doesn't cover also is administrative actions.
Right.
So if, again, I'm sorry, I'm using you as an example, Major Cooper.
It's cool, man.
if you're prosecuted and convicted in state court for a civilian offense like DUI, that does not preclude a GOMAR, a reprimand from the general. Mm-hmm. It does not, and you could also be administratively separated from the Army, an officer elimination action for that conviction. And that's not punishment. It feels like punishment. Just because you may feel punished about it. However, it is an administrative action based on a criminal offense.
Yes, yeah, absolutely.
Well, I took from that essentially, there's different variables that have to be considered. Mm-hmm. So you can't blankly say, you know, it's treated differently or double jeopardy is or isn't taken.
There's a lot of variables. Okay. There's a lot of interplay between the systems. There's a lot of cooperation between us and state authorities to make sure we're not double punishing.
Right.
But there's also an accountability piece.
I understand. So, can y'all just quickly explain the difference between like barracks inspections, health inspections, or health and welfare inspections? Because, you know, we got this all the time when I was in command. You know, some soldiers say, you know, you can't look through my barracks or you can only look through certain things. Oh, you can't even look through my POV, but it's 9 times out of 10, you know, it's on government property. You know, they're staying in government property. Can you guys just kind of clarify that?
Yeah, so there's a couple of different things there. So first, the commander is responsible for the health and welfare and safety in their unit, right? We all basically understand that. So what a commander can do is conduct health and welfare inspections or checks, which we've all heard of and probably have enjoyed from time to time. So how that works is basically the commander comes up with certain days that they want to conduct these inspections. They are to be completely random. And what that commander is doing is basically just ensuring through an inspection of either the barracks or anything sort of within that commander's area, which could sometimes include privately owned vehicles, for example, is just to make sure that there's nothing in either those barracks or other areas that that commander controls that are going to be problematic for health, welfare, and safety. So we're looking for things like drugs. We're looking for cleanliness of your room, even, right? Just to make sure that soldiers are living in a clean environment and in a safe environment. And so the commanders have the ability to do that. And normally the TTP for that is that the commander is going to pick those dates well ahead of time and that those dates are going to be basically shared through very few people in the unit so that they can truly be random. That's different than a situation where, say, a soldier goes up to the commander and says, I think that Special Smith is using drugs. I think he's smoking pot in the barracks. And the commander evaluates whether or not that soldier is telling the truth or can be relied upon. So, for example, does that soldier actually know Special Smith? Is this soldier a good soldier, someone who you rely on? Various other things that they may consider. For that commander to then turn around and say, tomorrow we're doing a health and welfare inspection, or we're doing a health and welfare inspection right now, and that wasn't already pre-planned, and the commander's doing it based on that information about Special Smith and his supposed drug use, that's a search.
Got it.
And that's a very different thing. And so in order to conduct that search, the commander has to have probable cause, which he may very well have from what that soldier has told him, depending on the reliability of that advice. There's a whole separate thing that the commander will go through to be able to conduct a search. And that's usually either some type of warrant, for example, through a magistrate that can allow that commander to do that. Or you could simply ask Special Smith, hey, Special Smith, I'd really like to come in and search your room and tell Special Smith, hey, I have information.
Does he have a right to refuse?
Absolutely.
Okay.
He does. In that case, he absolutely does. And so that commander is going to work with their attorney to figure out what the best course of action is. But that is not a health and welfare inspection. So two very, very different.
But if I have if Soldier A came to me and said, hey, Specialist Smith is smoking marijuana and stuff like that, can I do my 4 or 10% your analysis the next morning and add him to the urine analysis?
So consider that just like doing the barracks room search. They're both searches.
Gotcha.
Okay. The reason that we're allowed to do those urine analysis tests, again, is for health and welfare. And so when we're doing a random urine analysis, that's what it is. It's a random urine analysis generated randomly by a computer program or by a DA6 or however it is you end up doing that. But no, you would not be able to add Specialist Smith to that particular urine analysis. You would, again, contact your lawyer. They would determine whether or not you can do a probable cause urine analysis, which is one of the types of urine analysis that you can do. You may have enough information to actually do that. And then that would be completely squared away. But it's not random when we're adding people to it based on information that we've received.
All right. So I have a question that many of our AUSA chapter members have asked AUSA. So I'm hoping that you will be able to assist. And the question essentially is, how should AUSA chapter members deal with getting on post when they have been invited to an event, to a meeting, or to such?
So the first part of that question is to determine who has actually invited the chapter members. So in order to gain access onto POST as a non-federal entity or a private organization member, you have to be invited by the right person. So that's either going to be the senior mission commander or the garrison commander. If you want to be invited, then it's just a request to either of those individuals, either the garrison commander or the senior mission commander, normally done in writing. They receive a legal review on that, and then we'll be able to invite you onto post. Once that has happened, it should be as easy as going to whatever visitor's gate you have to get onto that particular installation and taking whatever anyone else would use to get onto an installation, right? So you've got to have your driver's license or photo ID.
Insurance, all that.
Insurance, vehicle registration, all that's current and checks out. You should be allowed onto post.
Okay.
Right.
So, ma'am, going back to your administrative punishment discussion we had earlier in the podcast, toss up for either one of y'all. So discuss bars as a corrective tool. So I used bars a lot when I was a commander. I mean, I did have one soldier, and this is disgusting, but did not take shower for multiple days. So I put a bar on him, you know, with, you know, the legal advice from my judge advocate. So can you just go into a little bit further?
Absolutely. So bars to reenlistment are covered in Army Regulation 601-280, which, again, along with 600-20, I think is a really great reg for soldiers to take a look at. That regulation discusses reenlistment, and a part of that regulation is bars to reenlistment and when a commander can bar a soldier from reenlisting. And what you'll see in that regulation is a commander can bar a soldier from reenlisting for a whole host of reasons, to include exactly what you just said, things like overall cleanliness, refusing to take a shower, for example.
He was smelly.
You've also things like APFT failure or, you know, not being able to perform the duties of your MOS to standard. And so really what it comes down to is this idea, and this is actually a quote from the reg, but it's only soldiers of high moral character, personal competence, and demonstrated adaptability to the requirements of the professional soldier's moral code will be reenlisted in the active Army. So if a commander feels like a soldier falls outside of that, they can simply bar them from reenlistment. Now, a bar from reenlistment is not a punitive action. So it is not meant to punish a soldier. It is actually meant to be a rehabilitative tool.
Get their attention.
Right, exactly. And there's a counseling requirement built into that too. So if you are a leader in a unit, you're a squad leader or a platoon sergeant, and you want one of your soldiers to be barred from reenlisting, you will now have some responsibilities as a member of that command to actually counsel that soldier. And the counseling requirements are listed in that regulation. If a soldier does not overcome the bar after a certain period of time, you may have to initiate separation, but that's after certain counseling requirements have been met and that soldier has not changed that behavior or become better at, say, their job.
Good. Got it. I understand. All right. So here's one of the big questions that we've also been asked as well, too. So marijuana has been legalized in about 5 or 6 states. And sir, I see you reaching for your UCMJ manual right here. So we have Washington, Colorado, California, and I believe Alaska. So they understand that they're federal employees and they cannot partake. So has the UCMJ been reduced for punishment in those states, or is it based on the commander saying that? And then you always get the case of, oh, I was at a party and there was smoking in the air, or I accidentally ate this brownie that I did not know had this stuff in it. So within those states, what kind of stuff are y'all seeing? What kind of advice can y'all give?
Okay, so yeah, I did grab my manual for courts martial. It's my baby. I love it.
It's the 2019 edition, I might point out.
Yeah, sir, go ahead and tell them where they can find that out.
So if you go to the Joint Services Committee on Military Justice webpage, it's jsc.gov, you can download a copy of the manual for courts martial. It's not a secret document. We don't hide it from anybody. We publish it and make it public. The Library of Congress is also publishes all of the manuals for courts martial going back to the 1900s. So again, these documents are publicly available because these are public laws and public rules. But so the reason it's interesting is the marijuana was only legalized under state law for those states. So California, Washington, Colorado, I believe the District of Columbia have legalized some possession and some of those states, the distribution of marijuana. That's under their state law. This goes back to sort of the dual systems I was talking about. Marijuana is still a Schedule I controlled substance under federal law. The federal government could step in and shut down Colorado's marijuana industry anytime they wanted to. They have decided not to. So for whatever reasons, they have declined to proceed against prosecutions or investigations against businesses that are in violation of federal law. That's it's more of a prosecutorial discretion. As far as the Uniform Code of Military Justice goes, it's an Article 112 Alpha of the Uniform Code of Military Justice. Marijuana is a specifically prohibited substance.
Period.
It's not even a Schedule I substance. Even if it was no longer a Schedule I substance under federal statute, the Uniform Code of Military Justice specifically says you shall not use marijuana. The other ones are cocaine, heroin, opium, amphetamines. There's a whole list of specific offense of specific substances you may not touch. They are verboten. So you can't use them, you can't sell them, you can't possess them.
It makes it easy.
Yeah. So if you're in Washington State, it doesn't really matter because it's not so much a question of employment. You said because we're federal employees. We're not federal employees. It's our status as soldiers. We are subject to the code at all times of the day. As long as you are in an active duty status, you are subject to the code.
But now that you said active duty status, my next question is to toss up with the reserves and National Guard.
As far as the Uniform Code of Military Justice is concerned, if you are not in a Title 10 status, if you are in your regular civilian status, you cannot be prosecuted for use of marijuana, use of drugs, because you're not subject to the code at that time. But if you're on IT training, you're in training status, or you've been called to active duty for training or something along those, and you pop positive for marijuana, you're at risk there because the question is, did you use that marijuana while you were on an active duty status?
Interesting.
So you're sort of taking your life and your career into your own hands there. As a trial defense counsel, I would advise soldiers it's probably not the best idea if you're a reservist or a National Guard to do it because you're just creating risk for yourself.
Absolutely.
Is it worth it? Is it that awesome that you have to do it?
No.
So if you're in one of those states, you're restricted from possessing it. How do you associate with civilian friends that might be using it? Again, how much risk do you wish to assume with your career to hang out with people that want to smoke marijuana?
And one thing to point out, too, about what Adam just said in the beginning when he was talking about the manual for courts martial, the 2019 edition, If you are listening to this and you're thinking to yourself, I have a manual from a couple of years ago. My trial counsel gave it to me and it's sitting on my desk. A lot of things in that manual have changed.
Good point.
After the Military Justice Act of 2016, which actually took effect 1 January 2019, a lot of things in that book have changed. A lot of our processes have changed. I highly, highly, highly recommend that you go to the JSC website and you download the new manual for courts martial.
And if you're a company commander or battalion commander, you're a commander at any level, if you haven't already received training or a briefing from your SJA or from your group or brigade judge advocate, you should go talk to them.
Absolutely.
A lot of new authorities for commanders that have been put in there. A lot of new options for commanders have been put in there. It's a brand new book and probably the biggest change we've seen in the manual for courts martial since the UCMJ was passed in the 1950s. So.
Well, I must say, as a civilian who does not dabble in marijuana, I like the fact that the Army is putting people at a higher level or, you know, making it a standard of, I'll say, greatness for our Army soldiers. So that's a good thing.
And it's really about readiness, right? I mean, that's what the Army has been focused on and should be focused on is readiness and what was called by former Secretary of Defense Mattis, readiness and lethality. And so if it's not something that contributes to readiness
or lethality,
exactly. So marijuana just simply does not make us more ready, right? Actually the opposite.
And I, like I said, having spent a lot of time at Fort Bragg in my career, the ones we always thought about were the guys packing the chutes, the riggers. You really don't
I don't need a rigger high packing my chute.
Or the guy fixing your vehicle or the gal fixing your vehicle and all the things that we do or the lawyer giving you advice. Really don't want those people high.
It's even worse.
So that's, I think, where a lot of that comes from. I've heard the counter arguments. What about alcohol? And there's some disconnects between some of that, between how alcohol is treated and marijuana is treated. But you know, when you get into that argument, you just go back to the book and say, well, right now alcohol is legal and marijuana is not. And so we're disciplined soldiers and we are rule followers because we're disciplined soldiers. Yeah. So that's the best way to approach it, to get your mind around it.
So, sir, thanks for the clarification on the marijuana. So here's a scenario. Soldier's chaptered out because he was using drugs and receives a general discharge. Or an other than an honorable discharge. So after 6 months, some soldiers are saying that discharge is automatically upgraded. So can you guys further explain that after 6 months?
Well, the simple answer is no, that's not true. It's not an automatic upgrade. There is a process to request that your discharge be upgraded through the Army Board of the ABCMR.
The Army Board for Correction of Military Records.
I love acronyms. Acronyms are great. acronyms mean you don't have to remember the words.
Thanks for clearing them all up today.
So it's a process. It's a request. Nothing happens automatically. There's too much of a bureaucracy for that to happen. So yeah, if you get a discharge from the military, that's something other than an honorable discharge, general or OTH, you can petition for an upgrade, and it is a process, and you have to present evidence. And because the default is that there's a presumption of administrative regularity, which is that there's an assumption that everything was done correctly, and the burden is on the person wanting the upgrade to prove that they are entitled to or deserve an upgrade, or it is a matter of fairness. And they do upgrade quite a few. I mean, they look at those cases, and they go before the board. And they look for injustices. And so it is an opportunity. But
it's basically the council going back and looking like how they were prosecuted. It's not, hey, in the last 6 months, I've been doing good and I've been helping out little old ladies and I've been picking up trash on the street. I've been being a good citizen. That does not get considered.
They might look and say, hey, this person has transitioned to civilian society and they are trying to make something of their life and they don't necessarily need the weight of what we call bad paper weighing them down. So there is some of that. You can certainly submit that, whether they care about it or not is a different story. But there's you can start talking about, if you're in your process of how you're transitioning to civilian life and all the things and how you've bettered yourself and how you would like the benefit of a better discharge. So there's you can certainly make that as part of your argument, but it doesn't necessarily have to be that something was done wrong to you. Your case may have been processed perfectly normally, but often, like I said, they're using sort of an interest of justice type standard because again, you weren't prosecuted, you were administratively discharged, you were fired. And so there's paperwork that comes with that, that employers might look at. Well, employers want to see your DD-214 and they're looking for those words, honorable discharge. And so they might say, hey, look, this is limiting my employment opportunities. Upgrading your discharge may also affect your ability to request veterans benefits or GI benefits that you might have lost through not getting a honorable discharge. So there's lots of second and third order effects that might be addressed through a petition to the ABCMR for an upgrade in your discharge. But if you're, I ran a regional defense council office. I can tell you, we've never, ever, ever told soldiers that their discharges will be automatically upgraded after 6 months. That is truly a barracks myth.
It is. And one thing to remember, too, is if you're a soldier in your first enlistment and you receive a general discharge, your education benefits are gone. Your GI Bill benefits are gone. And so these upgrades, they could make a real difference. But again, nothing is automatic. And you will have to petition to have that happen.
Very nice. This was very informative, and I believe our listeners will be very happy with the information that you shared to help guide them to any advice they need to discuss with their legal team within their command. So thank you both for coming out and discussing and dispelling the Barracks myth. We really appreciate that. To all of our listeners, thanks for joining us. Be sure to subscribe to the Army Matters podcast on iTunes and everywhere podcasts are found. Keep it locked in here for all Army Matters. And for next week's episode, enjoy Family Voices.
AUSA is the U.S. Army's professional association, a voice for the Army and support for the soldiers.
For more information about AUSA or to become a member, visit AUSA.org.